has to be getting near the end. Running out of time. Numbers chapter 27. Who wants to lead us in prayer and get us started tonight? Get them all here to do that.
I'll do it.
Thanks, John.
Dear Father in heaven, we come to you now at this hour, thankful for this time. We can come together and look into your word. Father, we're thankful for each one here. We ask you to be with the teachers this evening. Help them to bring your word in a way that's easily understood. Help us to open our hearts and our ears and our minds and to take in what you'd have us to know, Father. So thankful for your son and the sacrifice that he gave for us. And it's due to his name we pray.
All right, so last week talked a little bit about, chapter 25, that great kind of the parallels of golden calf debacle, that great sin of Baal Peor, where at Balaam, we don't learn that until chapter 31, we're going to be at tonight, but at Balaam's instigation, the Midianites in particular who were allied with the Moabites, the Spirit of God will allow Balaam to curse. He pronounces blessing instead. Balak's frustrated. Balaam still really wants that payday. And so, and it's so often the case, God will protect you. You become your own worst enemy. And so when women are involved and sex is involved, things happen. And so great sin, the rise of Phinehas, kind of showing himself to be a worthy, heir of Aaron. And someone's better than Aaron. Aaron participated in the debacle of the golden calf. Here, Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron, takes the lead in stopping the plague, dealing with the sin, and so forth. And then we turn the page of chapter 26, the second big census in the book. And again, we know there's some changes. This is the rise of the second generation. The census is emphatic that outside of Caleb, everybody who came out of Egypt is dead under the appointed age of 20. And so the wilderness, the Exodus generation is gone. Other things that we notice, the first census talked about men of war, emphasized war. Here that's only mentioned once. Now we're really doing it, and the text is explicit, we're really doing this because we're going to allot the land per capita. I looked it up if you were right. No, that's again, promise, hope, future, that God's promise is going to be kept. Why does that matter? Again, larger context. The blessing has been pronounced, right? Balaam did not want to do it. But the blessing isn't pronounced. The blessing that tags off of the promise to Abraham. This is going to happen. And the other big takeaway from chapter 26, all the numbers and names and details, but despite the fact that the population has stayed relatively stable within a rounding error, within a polling margin, which the whole point is God's got, it's another generation. God has gotten them through all of this. With one little exception, the corporate number of Israel has essentially held firm, one tribe has not. One tribe is greatly diminished. Simeon. Remember your Bible maps where Simeon kind of, that map, if it's dated from the days of Joshua or whatever, Simeon's actually got some allotment. And then you go to, days of King David or afterwards, and Simeon's kind of like, in the middle of Judah, just gone, depending on your map. The diminishment of Simeon begins early, and of course that's because of Simeon is involved, one of the tribes involved in rebellion, major, even higher rebellion. And so the judgment of God seen in even the beginning of the fading away of that tribe in this second census. All right, we turn the page to chapter 27. We alluded to this just a little bit at the end of last week, but part of what happens with the daughters of Zelophehad here, several things again that are worth picking up on. Legitimate question. Moses does the right thing and goes to God to get an answer. But several takeaways. Why tell us this story? Why do we need to know this? Why labor on a story that's always going to be an exception? Right? How many men are going to have only daughters who really deal? Why did we need to? All the other questions I got about the wilderness years, all the other questions I got about the law of God and what did you do in this situation or that situation? Why this really odd exception, exception? Why spend this much text, this late in the story, doorstep of the promised land? Why this?
So, I guess the way I would look at it would be that in this society, women were always subservient to their husbands or their dads or their, whatever. But when it came to the allotment of land, because it was a heritage, God viewed that more as an equal share. Not a hierarchical family kind of thing.
Okay.
It was they're part of this family, that family gets a portion, they are absolutely right,
yeah.
They deserve that portion.
Yeah. And they even emphasize that our father's name not be forgotten.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
we get married, you know, we take our husband's name or whatever. We, you know, with no sons, dad's name will be forgotten, which is, you know, in that world, you know, essentially being lost, being, you know, you have lost someone now. And so, you know, it's an immense amount of piety. It's understanding the logic of the land and the significance of the land. Again, why Naboth wouldn't sell his to Ahab. You know, God gave my family this stuff. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, good or not, or whether I could have a better peace. This is from God. It's a gift. And so we want to preserve our father's name. The other thing is it's a statement of faith. Think about this. How confident are they? You know, is this a real issue that you really want to, you know, bug Moses and God about if you're not sure you're going to make it in the land or not? Why even bring this up right now? Because we believe this is going to happen. It's actually an act of faith as well, besides an act of piety towards their family. Yeah, John.
I don't recall that ever happening, but also was it the year Jubilee, the 50th year, where they would all go back to their land?
Correct. Correct.
I never really recall it ever.
No, the people never kept it, at least in the Old Testament, mentioned it.
But it would be their land.
Yeah, well, and that's why, again, this original going in the land days of Joshua, when the lots are cast and the lines are drawn, it mattered, because this was, you know, especially if they had kept the law all the way through on this point, you know, these would have been the 1948 boundaries, you know, you see the modern Israel maps, right, you know, which Israel, 1948, 1967, 19, you know, because of all the different wars and scuffles that they've had over there, which boundaries. This was, and so make sure that our family, this clan, this branch of the tribe of Manasseh, is not lost. That's exactly right. There's one other thing that's hanging over this entire. I'm sorry, Yvette, you went in on this?
Also, that God is not partial with righteousness, because she said that her dad was not in the thing with Korah. So there had to be something there that they were taught.
Good.
Something, and because we've all sinned. So he died in his own sin. I think it's also showing a righteousness and a favor toward women that had that not happen, there would not have been an example to execute that kind of
good. Righteousness. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. In fact, let me develop that for just a sec. You know, one thing that God will say when Moses brings it before him is the women are right. In other words, even without an explicit law being given yet, they have rightly intuited the logic of how God looks. Like, what is righteousness ultimately? I mean, it's certainly defined by the law, but ultimately, you know, part of the difference of the Old and New Covenant is we got to get to a point where you don't need the training wheels and the lines, you can't figure out unless God tells you. We want you so thoroughly remade. You know, remember Paul, Romans 12, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You want to be so thoroughly remade by the Word of God and thus by the Spirit of God through the Word that you can even kind of think, without being told explicitly, you can intuit, you can think righteously the way God would think of these settings. You don't have to be told, you get it. This is what I should do in this moment. And so God's basically saying, these are, and why does that matter? This actually is still a great segue into it, because these women are also meant to be a big contrast. There is, hanging over this entire section from 25 to chapter 31, you know, from the beginning of the Baal Peor incident to chapter 31, when God tells them to go avenge him against the Midianites over what happened, and that includes killing Balaam. So really got bookends, 25 and 31, and everything in between. You know, when you got like the beginning of the story and then the end of the story, what does it tell you? The stuff in between is in some way meant to be a commentary, application, implication, some sort of genre of what's going on, okay? And so here's the thing. We met a Midianite woman who's evil. Cosby was her name in chapter 25, right? The leader of Israel who takes her into his tent, and he's doing what he does. But we're giving her name and her dad. Why does that matter? Because her dad's going to show up in chapter 31 too. We don't read those names. We don't pay attention. It matters. And so here's what's hanging over this whole story as well: is you've got an evil woman who, you know, leads, you know. I mean, granted, there were others, but you know, by giving her a name and emphasizing her participation with the leader of Israel, you know, kind of a Proverbs 7, kind of woman leading somebody into sin with her sexuality, idolatry, versus leading Israel to disaster, versus the rise of the virtuous good woman, or women in this case, who do think the way God thinks, and are saying we stay out of a lot of this big sin that's been going on around here. I mean, you know, we all suffer as a nation together in this stuff, but you know, we've been saying, you know, everybody's guilty of Kadesh Barnea, but we've stayed out of the stuff that's been going on in the wilderness. We're not that family. And so the contrast of Cosby in chapter 25, census, new generation, do we have some righteous thinking people in this generation? Well, yeah, how about starting with some righteous thinking women who God says, yeah, these women are right. They get it. They've learned how to think along the lines that I think about this kind of stuff. And that matters too for some other stuff that's coming up here in just a sec before we get to chapter 31. The rise of the resetting of men and women on some stuff. And so you've got that. These women are worthy foils to Cosby, but they're not going to be the only ones we meet in this section. All right? And then transition, a little bit more about transition. But on for sake of time, and we talked about Moses and Joshua a bit last week, but on for sake of time. So the next thing, the big thing that happens, chapter 28 and 29, more law. More law. And we talked already about that dynamic. Every time there's a big sin, what do you get? More law. But this matters, but why this kind of law? When you look at chapter 28 and chapter 29, look at the actual law that's given, the bulk of it. Just in those chapters, we'll talk about the law that's given in chapter 30 in a minute, because it makes sense in its own place. But chapter 20, the law, it's not moral law as such that we think of it. It's what, you know, sometimes we call ceremonial law, right? But it's not just any kind of ceremonial law. This matters. Why give this law in this moment? A couple of reasons. And we're going to go line by line. That was a little bit, I guess you missed it. Two reasons what this stuff does here, though, because a lot of this is actually in Leviticus. I'm only half joking. It's the calendar. Two things. Number one, new generation. And well, how has the old generation just died? Basically, because we watched them disappear in chapter 25. Breaking essential Ten Commandments kind of stuff, like no other gods before me, no adultery. I mean, just, you know, kind of, let's see how many of the ten they broke, right, in that moment. So you have a new generation. What does the new generation need? The new generation kind of needs a little reminder of who they are and what they are. But why these laws? Look where it starts. Look where the law starts, chapter 28. Daily offerings to Sabbath offerings to monthly offerings. And then about verse 16, you transfer from the basic cycle that comes every month. You know, you have a daily offering? Do you have days every month? Yeah, you do. Here's the offering for that. Do you have a Sabbath every week? Yep, you do. Here you go. Does every month have a beginning of the month? Yep, so here you go. So these regular cycles of time. Then after a month, what usually we think of? We think of year. So that's when you switch to the annual festival starting in verse 16. And you start, and you go through the calendar in that order, now, you know, in a sense. Just like we went from least, you know, smallest day to weekly, the Sabbath, to monthly. Then you start with the beginning of their calendar. Their first month was where Passover sits. And so you start with now yearly stuff. You got Passover, and then comes the Feast of Weeks, which is called Pentecost in the New Testament. Feast of Weeks. And then again, pretend that chapter breaks down there because they're always in the wrong place. Then comes seventh month stuff. Seventh month got a bunch of stuff. Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, and Feast of Booths. And thus you cycle through the annual calendar. And the Feast of Booths was a big one. We think about Passover. Feast of Booths was a big one, but that's a different class in a different quarter. And that's why it's belabored the most. It matters much more than we realize. We think about Passover. Booths matter for a lot of reasons. And Zechariah tells us about that, the prophet. Anyways. So what you do is you move through the calendar twice, once the regular cycle from daily to Sabbath to monthly, then the annual from Sabbath to weeks to seventh month stuff. And so you have all the cycles. So here's why belabor that? Well, again, what just happened in chapter 25? You know, the sexual stuff, but they were worshiping Baal Peor. And so what does he basically reiterate here? Here's what you worship, and here's when you do it, and how you do it. That's exactly right. And how you do it, okay? You know, because all, you know, we think about sacrifice, we think about sin sacrifices. We forget, set aside your sin, individual sin, national sin, whatever. Was there just basically regular routine worship that's supposed to be constantly being offered? These are the people of God. Yes. And so as you're about to go in the land, new generation, you know, you just messed with Baal for the first time over here. Let me reiterate symbolically the essence of who you are. You worship me. This is when and how you do it. Which, by the way, means they're worshiping a lot. You know, in fact, if you're worshiping this much, you don't have a lot of time to worry about Baal. Unless you're not going to church enough, right? You get how this works. The more you're with, the more you're in God's house, or with God's people, doing God's stuff, what do you have less time to be doing?
Making wrong stuff.
Yeah. Worrying about Baal, that's right. Yes, ma'am.
It's also like not relaying a foundation. The foundation was laid in the beginning.
Right.
But it's like cleaning it all to rebuild on the proper foundation
correct.
Again.
That's right.
Because they're going into a new land that's mm-hmm. going to be theirs, and just like our lives being unblemished, God wants an unblemished people.
That's right.
The land, everything unblemished.
As you go in the land, you remember you worship me. And you worship me a lot. And remember too, this is easily missed. When God first has Moses challenge Pharaoh about letting the people go in the first place, do you remember what Moses, back early in Exodus, what the message Moses actually delivers to Pharaoh? Let the people go that they may... The whole point of the Exodus was not so finally, kind of get retired. I can finally retire and do what I want. That was the point of being there. What was God rescuing them from slavery for? To what end? To what purpose? This. And so especially after chapter 25 and that generation, you got a new generation. Guys, remember why I've saved you. Which, by the way, is something to help our young people understand. You're not just saved from the world and sin. You are saved for something. In a sense, going to church is the point. Dress rehearsal for eternity. That is the point. And I remember when I was a kid, it was boring. I get it. We're all immature at that point. Now, we need to be helping our children, our young people, grow out of that and understand there really is, this is not just a matter of punching the clock. This is that for which we were created. Just like this is that, this is the reason they were brought out of Egypt. And so especially in light of what's just happened, especially as we establish a new generation, especially as they're about to go into the land of promise, remember why we're here. You are here to worship, and so relay that foundation. Yes, ma'am. Or yes, sir.
One thing that always fascinates me when I read this is the number of perfect animals that had to be available. When you go back and read history and the way that these days played out and the sacrifices, it was a terrible, bloody scene.
Yeah.
Because of the sheer number of animals that were being sacrificed.
Yeah.
And they all had to be perfect.
Yeah.
And everything. So. Not only did God make the requirement, he made the perfect sacrifices for that action that these people had to engage in.
Yeah.
And it just when you start looking at the numbers, the number's just huge.
Yes. Yep. Yep. And that's why, especially once the temple gets built, you begin to understand what an operation, and why there was also the temptation to monetize it.
Yeah.
Because that is a lot of, especially in an agricultural, agrarian society, that is a lot of money. That is a lot of capital flowing through there.
Yep.
It's really tempting to figure out a way to monetize this thing.
Yep.
So absolutely.
And you can kind of understand why Jesus was so irritated.
Absolutely.
About it, because
you're still in the temple and you're still doing you're still punching this clock in a literal sense.
Yep.
But your hearts are so far gone from what this was supposed to.
It's no longer about serving God. It's about how can I make a buck out of this.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so there's that. Then we go, now look at the very end of chapter 29. Summary statement, I'm going to pick up in verse 39 there at the end of the chapter that helps us transition into chapter 30 and this other law, this easily forgotten thing about the law about vows. It gets a little bit weird for us because it's about women and when they can and can't take vows vis-a-vis their husbands and fathers. But the setup starts in chapter 29. Summary statement, verse 39, these you shall offer to the Lord at your appointed feasts, in addition to your vow offerings and your freewill offerings, for your burnt offerings and for your grain offerings and for your drink offerings and for your peace offerings. All right, that vow and freewill offering that leads the list here. So here's the deal. What we've been doing in these past couple of chapters is corporate. This is national level, right? This is what the priests are in, everyone's giving their tithes, everybody's giving what they're supposed to be giving. The priests are thus got the operating budget they need. And this is really the priests running this for the nation in the tabernacle later in the temple, right? But what about you individually? You wanted to worship. Well, that's where people could take vows or free will offerings. We think about worship in terms of sin offerings. Again, God intended his people to be a worshiping people. So the sin offerings were, of course you do that when you, and that's not really worship. I mean, it's worship, but it's not regular worship. God figured, expected, that his people individually would still want to worship him, commune with him in the temple through free will offerings, through making vows. You remember how the book began in early chapter 6, Nazarite vow? All this holiness, you're looking around those holiness, but you're just a run-of-the-mill, you're not a priest, you're not a Levite. Man, I wish I could join in the holiness as an individual. What could you do? Nazarite. Take that vow, at least for a season, and join in that kind of extra dedicated holiness to the Lord. You know, God thinks that there could be my people who are going to want in on this. They're going to go above and beyond. And so what happens to the individual who wants to join in this worship of God? Free will. In Leviticus chapter 3, something's called the peace offering, the shalom offering, the fellowship offering. But, you know, that type of an offering where you don't have to do it. You just, you're so thankful to God and so happy to be his person. You want to have an extra sacrifice where you and God can share the meal together. Because that was a sacrifice that the regular Israelite could eat when they did, because it wasn't for sin. You just want to worship God. You're thankful. You're grateful. He's a great God. He's kept his word, promised it. You want it on this. So that's the beginning of the transition. Now you got individuals who, aside from this wondrous corporate constant worship, individuals who want in on this, okay? So here's the thing, though. Here's the thing. What happens when a woman wants in on this, but makes a vow that in some way obligates the family, whether it's her husband, her father, whatever, you know? And so, and that can get a little bit bumpy. And so you have, transitioned into chapter 30, Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes of Israel, saying, this is what the Lord commanded. If a man vows a vow to the Lord and swears not to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. So that's the basic principle, and that's why we need some regulation here beyond the basic principle, because basically what's it saying here? If you make a vow, what? Remember Ecclesiastes chapter 5? Better not to make a vow than the vow would not pay. When the messenger comes, don't say it was an accident. And the whole idea is, because your vows were usually like kind of some sort of public, or the temple had a record of it. So when the temple sends for the ox you vowed, or the gold you vowed, or whatever, don't say, I thought I might have cancer, and I just wanted to make a vow to the Lord that he's going to get me out of this. And I, thankfully don't have cancer. It was the heat of the moment. Wasn't in a good place mentally. I really can't afford this. Rash vows are dangerous vows. That's Jephthah. You make a vow, God expects you to?
Do it.
Basic principle. Okay. So what happens when daughter or wife decides to vow the entire herd and husband or dad doesn't know it? So, there are, depending on how you want to divide this up, there are kind of four classes of women here that are then covered. You've got unmarried daughters still in their father's house. You've got women who are not married, who get married, and their husband finds out about the vow they've made. So maybe dad was okay with it, but then when you marry her, are you obligated for the oath? Because her dad was okay, because that's part of the principle here, if you've read this chapter, is husband or dad has to validate the vow when they find out about it. Otherwise, you're not guilty of verse 2 if you're a woman who vowed. Dad, father, husband need to have a say in some of this, especially if it's going to implicate the family. Because they're the head of the house, they're the head of the clan, the tribe, as you work with the hierarchies of the social structure. So you had basically unmarried daughters, you had women when they got married. Again, maybe dad was okay with the vow, but now new husband says, ho, I'm not sure I'm good with that. A new husband can undo his new wife's vow. You have divorcees and widows. What happens if you don't, the occasional woman who really didn't have a man in her life, a husband or a father. And then lastly, married women outright, just long-time married women, and a woman wants to make the vow while she's married. She doesn't bring a vow to the marriage. She makes the vow while she's married. Kind of four categories, four classes. And the bottom line is, and again, you have to see this in the context of the worship and the vowing coming out of chapter 29. It seems a little bit weird to us, but first of all, God really does expect men to leave their homes. Number two, you got to also see this not just in terms of the worshiping context that we're coming out of, and this is a form of individual worship that the husband needs to kind of have a say in, or the father needs to have a say in. But you also have to put it back into, remember, we're in between chapter 25 and 31, right? And so remember what we just saw about the daughters of Zelophehad balancing Cosby the Midianite? So what we've still got here now is another echo of that kind of thing. Because if you're looking at husbands and wives, let's frame it that way in particular. husbands and wives and worship getting messed up, a relationship to God's getting messed up because husband wasn't really doing his job and staying on top of the family in its right ordering. That ring a story, a very early story, a very old story early on. Adam and Eve. And yes, technically he's not making a vow, but the bottom line is who is setting the tone, setting the agenda for the relationship with God, and who's following along and eating? It's backwards, right? You always forget that line there when you read that story. She took, she ate, she ate to her husband with her. He was there. He did not do his job. He did not superintend the right worship, the right relationship to God of his family, such as it was at that point. And catastrophe resulted. Same thing then, fast forward back to chapter 25. You have the Midianite woman leading the Israelite man, a leader in Israel, in the idolatrous worship. So again, once again, you have the woman leading the man, and bad things happen, right? Because what's his name? I forget how he's, what tribe he's from. It's been a long week. It's been a week. But he could have said to her, this is not the way my God says to be done. Not gonna fornicate with you, nor are we gonna worship Baal. But rather, we doing it his way, or are we doing it his culture, his people, his patriarch, and his God's way, or are we doing it her people and her God's way? Right? And so as we're about to come back to chapter 31, as we're about to transition out of chapter 31, what are we back to? Men, the covenant men of God, lead your house in this stuff. It didn't go well in Genesis chapter 3. It did not go well in Numbers chapter 25 when men did not hold the line about how God is going to be worshipped and related to. And so it's kind of an echo of the old thing again. Why this here? Why now? That's probably why. Reasonable reading in context. Because we're in between 25 and 31, and literally you have a woman leading a man in rank, awful disobedience to God. And God is saying, I want men to run their houses. Fathers, don't let your daughter run the show. Husbands, don't let your wife run the show. Husbands and fathers are responsible for the rightly ordered worship and God-fearingness of their houses. Bottom line. Make sense? So it also kind of sits in context now and begins to kind of ring on several levels. Yeah, Lauren.
An interesting piece both to this and the daughters of the Lafayette is that if a woman is without a man, she is not absolved of responsibility.
Correct.
She still has the responsibility to follow God
on
her own if she doesn't. And yes, those are exceptions, but they're important ones, and that's why God mentions them.
Of course.
Because the women still need to think and to step up for themselves.
Correct. And that's why it sits right here in the middle of a story where things went crossways. And of course, in the center of it all is still worship of God. In the center, you've got the daughters of Zelophehad on the one hand, you've got the vowing stuff on the other. What's still in the middle? The law of all these days.
And even if the husband isn't, she still has to. Just like Abigail did, right, even though her husband wasn't.
Right. Yep, absolutely. All right, chapter 31, because the bell's going to catch us, and this always happens. Chapter 31. So now we're back to, kind of after this, in a sense, detour. Now we're back to, chapter 25 and the fallout. And so the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, avenge the people Israel on the Midianites, and afterward you shall be gathered to your people. So this is Moses' last ride. And so Moses spoke to the people, saying, arm men from among you to go to war, that they may go against Midian to execute the Lord's vengeance on Midian. So that's the thing. One of the things that troubles people about this story, like it will in the conquest stories, is when God says, wipe out the women and children too. But the text makes very clear this is not genocide as a modern construction or a modern concept, nor is this just bloodlust. What's the kind of the repeated concept here? Why are we doing this? Well, they didn't just try. They succeeded.
Right.
Yeah. And to that, remember too, the Midianites, so we dealt with the Moabites earlier, now we're dealing with the Midianites side of what had happened, starting back in chapter 22. The goal was to curse Israel. The goal was to thwart God's purposes for these people. And so, and remember back a couple weeks ago when we first got into this larger section, and we built it out of Genesis chapter 12. Those who bless you, I will bless. Those who curse you, I will curse. And so while the Spirit did not allow Balaam to curse them, by helping get them this way, was Balaam still essentially trying to curse them to bring them down? So is he still effectively cursing them? Are the Midianites participating in that? So what happens when you curse God's people?
Bad things.
And so the Lord says, avenge. This is a people that has forfeited collectively. And that troubles because we're modern American individualists. For most of human history, this includes in the Bible, people understood the concept of group culpability. You may be individually guilty. Daniel never sits in Babylon and says, you know, the Bible says I did nothing wrong. What does he do in Daniel chapter 9? We have sinned. He personally was not guilty. You know, one of the only men in the Bible, you know, one of the rare men in the Bible, when the Bible literally has no dirt on. No feet of clay, no moment of weakness, no bad day, no losing his temper. No. Daniel, Daniel, angel comes and says, you're a man highly esteemed in heaven. No meaningful guilt in the story. And yet, what does he say? We have sinned. Because what is he? He's a member of a group that collectively is sinful. And so that's what we don't think that way. Our American individualism is so thick. We just cannot comprehend that not only is that not how the world has worked for most of human history, but that's not always the way God seems to see it either. You know, you can suffer as part of a sinful group, the consequence when the sinful group gets its consequences, and still be individually blameless before God. And if you doubt that, go talk to Daniel when you meet him someday. Because that's how it works. And so these women, these children, you know, may have not been directly involved, but the bottom line is they are part of a group that has collectively attempted to thwart God's purposes and curse his people. And there's a consequence for that. And so God's repeating, no, this is divine vengeance. You know, Israel is just a tool, divine vengeance. This is God's means of executing vengeance on his enemies. Now here's the thing, verse 4, you shall send 1,000 from each of the tribes of Israel to war. Now that's symbolic too. If this is a vengeance for what you did to my people, 1,000 per tribe, in other words, a total of, that was your question on Wednesday night, 12,000. Is that symbolic? Yeah, that's symbolic. Because remember, you know, how big was the multitude that came out? Could they have mustered more? Yeah, they could have mustered more. This is meant to send, this is a message. And so, and to keep it going, verse 6. So Moses sent them to war, 1,000 from each tribe, together with Phinehas and Eleazar the priest. Oh, this is a holy war. You know, bring the priest to battle. And don't just bring any priest. Who are you bringing?
Phinehas.
Yeah, chapter 25. Yeah, this is the end of chapter 25. You said Phinehas started it. Phinehas is going to end this. And so we send Phinehas along as well. And then verse 8, or verse 7, they warred against Midian as the Lord commanded Moses, killed every male. They killed the kings of Midian with the rest of their slain, Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, Reva, the five kings of Midian. They look at that list of names. Guess what? When you go back and look at Cosby and see who her dad was, here he is. Because she was, you know, again, that's why we got Numbers chapter 30 here. That's why we got the daughters of Zelophehad here. We've got a bad daughter from a bad house. And bad things happened. And now God's executing his vengeance on that. We want daughters of Zelophehad. We want wives and daughters who are virtuous and worthy. And you know, that's what we want. We don't want Cosby's.
I'm just curious, Jeff, why is it that Moab's not mentioned? I mean, because Moab started it, and Balaam was advising the king of Moab. I mean, the Midianites were—I understand they were related and they worked with one another and all that. And obviously, the end of the scene is with the Midianites. I get that, but I'm just—I mean, is the Moabites, are they in here and they just didn't mention it, or are they dealt with in another way? I mean, what's the?
That's a great question. I do think it's where God is working backwards. So in other words, chapter 25 focuses especially on the Midianites and the Midianite role in what, you know. In other words, rather than learning the lesson of what happened to Balak with Balaam and it didn't work and just dropping it, they doubled down. The Midianites doubled down with Balaam's help. And so the most immediate threat, the most immediate success in defiling the people of God was the Midianites. And then what about Moab? Moab's time is coming. You know, eventually God will annihilate them with David. And the war of David against Moab is pretty clearly meant to settle old sins and grievances. So someone's just, you know, on level two, maybe just the mystery of why God, you know, how long does each nation get before they get their comeuppance? But yeah, I mean, I think when you go back and you look at the historical books on David's destruction of Moab, you know, it seems to be, at least my memory, you know, it seems to be meant to be a settling of these long debts, these old issues. But yeah, the most immediate thing was that chapter 25 debacle, so we saw that.
And I guess partly because that happens after they're already paying the price for having laid down with the women of Moab, and that makes it that much more egregious.
Oh,
that,
yeah,
that while the people are weeping over what's already happened to them, here comes,
yeah,
cause, yeah,
right.
I mean, so
the whole,
okay,
issue. Right. Well, and you know, just, you know, they literally drew blood. I mean, you know Moab, you know, Balak disappears from the story. Midian doesn't. And the other part of it too, is, remember, you know, we geographically, because the marker's going to help us kind of learn when to connect stuff. You know, we're in Shittim in chapter 25 when this happens, which is where we're going to be when Joshua takes over and they go to Jericho. They send the spies to Jericho, and so part of it may just be geographically, you know, that again, you know, whatever happened in chapter 22, that, you know, because remember, chapter 22 is associated with Kadesh. And then Shittim in chapter 25, so just geographically, we are still where the Midianite debacle happened. They may have in some ways literally moved past the Moab angle on this, even though everybody in the region was in on it to a point. So,
can I ask just a really,
sure,
curious question?
Sure.
There are times when God gets really, really angry, and he will send his angels to take care of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are times like this where God sends his people to go and take care of the problem.
Right.
Is there any insight that you've ever been able to come up with to be able to tell from you know, why God does it one way and does it a different way? Because it seems like this is such an egregious thing that God would just say, you know what?
Fire from heaven.
Sit over here. I'm just going to take care of this.
This is a book in which people have been struck with leprosy and the earth has swallowed people alive.
Right, right.
Yeah, why?
I don't know. I just always
hard for me to speak for the Lord.
Okay.
No,
I'm right there with you. But it's just an oddity that sometimes he takes it on himself.
Yeah.
And then sometimes he has the people actually do it.
The one observation I make that may give you a little bit of hint about this is, while yes, he did tell them to go out and do this.
Yep.
If you know, again, well, how the bell's going to catch us, we won't finish the story as such now. But if you read the rest of the story, you know, when they get, you know, when it's all said and done, they get back, they take a census. And they haven't lost anybody.
Yeah.
Is that a sign? Is that maybe symbolic? Because, you know, we send 12,000 out, and all 12, you know, so that starts with symbolism.
Yeah.
And then we come back with not a single one slain. Yeah, I think I know what that's about. They fought, but who really was fighting?
And then there were times when Israel was in disobedience, and they went out to war, and they almost got all wiped out.
Yeah, or you want to get in, just, you know, you want to king up all the nations, especially when the days of Saul come.
Yeah.
And so Israel fell with him. We almost forget, you know, we talk about Saul and Jonathan, now we forget, and Israel fell with
them. Yeah.
You want a king that can be, you know, you want a king up all the nations, that's a king that can lose. You want that kind of king, okay? But be prepared to lose.
Yep.
But yeah, so I think that's part of, you know, the hint in this chapter, that even though he made them do something, you know, didn't come back with 11,999,
right.
They came back with all 12.
Yeah.
So that's significant, I think. So that's probably the best I could say to that. All right, bell's going to catch us. Two more weeks, you know, and so we're in chapter 36, we're actually going to get there, I think. So next week, you know, we turn to chapter 32, and start looking at the kind of a little bit of a down payment, you know, where you do have Reuben and Manasseh and whatnot start to settle a little bit. So glimpses, down payments, hope. And so, yeah, it's getting exciting for them if you're living in that world. And again, we're just rejoicing watching God keep his promises to his people, because that means he'll keep his promises to us. So, anybody want the last word?
I have an idea of why. I think one is that God does it to show Israel, and when Israel does it, it's to show the people of the land.
Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, that's exactly right. And certainly, you know, I mean, you know, Rahab will say that to the spies that come across the Jericho. we've heard about your God. We know what you did. We know what you did to Egypt. We know what you did to these folks across the river. We know what you've been doing. We're terrified. So that's exactly right.